Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. This is a special bonus recording from last night's Vancouver Council by-election, West End Housing and Homelessness Forum at St. Andrew Wesley's United Church. The event was hosted by the West End Seniors Network, Watson Gopal LLP, Metro Vancouver Alliance, and Gordon Neighborhood House. Friend of the pod, Micah, invited us to attend and post a recording of the debate. The event ran late, so Scott and I haven't had a chance to record our follow-up thoughts yet. We'll do that tonight as part of our regular weekly podcast and have that out for you tomorrow. And before I throw it over to the recording, I should say that the first 4 minutes of this are a bit rough. The church gave me a copy of their recording from their sound system, but they missed the first few minutes. So I had to splice in the recording I took from my little recorder that was just sitting on the pew next to me. It picked up a lot of the echoes from the giant church, so you'll hear that. After Diego gets going, it switches over to the better audio, so you can enjoy the rest of the two-hour debate. You can find links to each of the candidates' pages in the show notes over at politicoast.ca. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at PoliticoastPod, and you can support the show at patreon.com/politicoast. I hope you enjoy the debate.
I also want to begin by acknowledging that we are on the traditional and unceded lands of the Coast Salish people, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh, and that this acknowledgement is centrally important to the topic that we discuss, with which we come together to engage over tonight. The issues of social justice that pertain to housing are also critical to the issues of reconciliation that inform our acknowledgement that we're on these lands. So Tom, I'm going to turn it over to you maybe to introduce the five candidates.
Okay, if the candidates are ready, we have, in order starting on my right, Diego Cardona from Vision, Gene Swanson, Pete Fry of the Green Party, and Hector Bremer of NPA.
Welcome to all of our candidates. I'm going to just take a few minutes and explain the process for this debate. We have five rounds of questions. The order in which the candidates will answer the question was determined by some complicated process of luck before the debate, and so you see them sitting in an order that reflects whatever it was that the organizers did to determine dispassionately their order, and we'll cycle through these candidates, so each has a turn being at every space in the round of answering questions. Tom and I are going to alternate our questions. We've got a slightly different format for each of the questions. Sometimes we'll ask a main question, then a follow-up question to everyone. Other times we'll have follow-up questions that are specific to each of the candidates. So Tom, let me turn it over to you. And I should say, by the way, to the candidates, that you each have 1.5 minutes for answering the question. Or sorry, you have 2 minutes for answering the initial question, and then 1.5 minutes for answering the follow-up question. We have one of the organizers in the audience who has color-coded cards. Orange means you're very close to having your time up, and red means your time is up, and we will be keeping time very strictly. After we go through 5 rounds of questions, each of the candidates will have another 90 seconds to have closing comments. Tom and I have some questions that were prepared beforehand. We also have some questions that have been submitted to us just now from the audience. So we're going to try and mix things up and sort of go with the conversation as it rolls out. And Tom, you're up with the first question.
Thank you, Michael. We'll start with Diego. Why is housing in Vancouver so unaffordable for so many? What are the economic forces? What can be done to make housing in Vancouver more affordable? Specifically, what are the most important things that the City of Vancouver, given its jurisdiction and resources, to ensure access to affordable and adequate housing? Please be clear about what is distinct about the position that you have relative to that of your colleagues.
Okay, that's good. Thank you, Ari, for coming tonight, and thank you for the question. I think there are many factors to why housing is so unaffordable today. Of course, the market, speculation, lack of regulation is one of them. The abandonment of a housing strategy by a former federal government, by several previous federal governments and the provincial government, is definitely also a factor. We didn't have a national housing strategy for a while. what I've said that I'm committed to do as a candidate in this election, if I get elected, what I think we can deliver immediately as a municipal government is that I put forward a plan to make sure that by the end of this year would include 1,000 new co-ops as a goal. I've said that what we can do as well is double the number of units allowed on single family lots from 3 to 6. I've also said that I will be an advocate for co-housing, which is a model that promotes affordable housing, while also promoting a sense of community and shared amenities amongst the people that live in there. I've also said that I will continue to support pre-zoning so that we can allocate below market rental units that are affordable and that are attached to local incomes. I think the big differentiation between, I think who, the person that the folks that I'm really, that the main, my main opponent is that I'm delivering things that we can do at the municipal level while being very hopeful of the new relationship that we have with the new provincial government that is willing to work with us to address the affordability and housing crisis.
Diego, thank you very much. I have a couple of follow-ups on that, which you can respond to. First, you mentioned 1,000 co-op units. Does that put a dent in the affordability problem, one? Two, is doubling enough on the single-family lots, or would people prefer to build large single-family deluxe homes, given the high price they command, or would they actually take it up? And in sum, is what you're proposing really going to make Vancouver an affordable city, or do you need more help from other levels?
Sure. Sorry, could you just clarify the first point of the follow-up?
1,000 co-op units is not, is that going to be enough to really make a meaningful difference to the city?
Absolutely. I think that the reality is that I'm hearing at the door that we need to do more. I hear you. You know, I'm a renter. I live in this city. I came here as an immigrant. I'm a former youth in care. I understand the struggles that people are living because I face them in my everyday life. Absolutely. I'm definitely going to push for more money from our other levels of government so that we can double or triple that goal. You know, we put forward 20 sites of city-owned land so that the provincial and federal government can use them. And we're actually, in the absence of their leadership, we're taking on the role of putting those sites to work. I think the things that I've said that we could deliver on are practical. We can actually deliver them on. Would it solve completely the affordability crisis? No, we do definitely need partners in the federal government and in the provincial government. You know, that's why I'm really excited about the possibility that we no longer have governments that are hostile towards City Hall in Ottawa and in Victoria, because they are essential to making this work. Those were federal and provincial responsibilities that municipalities are now picking up the pieces because they're impacting people's lives, they're impacting my life, they're impacting the lives of my peers. So definitely we need all three levels of government and work to address the root of the crisis.
Thank you very much. Judy, you again get the same main question. What are the forces driving unaffordability in Vancouver? And what is it that you propose the city ought to be doing to enhance affordability?
Okay. Now, is it better if we stand, or does it?
You know, I think it's probably fine if you sit, but you probably do need to lift your mic and speak into it.
Unlike what I was just doing.
Forces that are impacting the city are similar forces to those that have impacted across Canada for the past 30-odd years. The federal government took the tax breaks that it gave to the development of rental housing and moved them over to the development of condo housing on the dream that every Canadian would own their own home. The dream didn't pan out, but what it's meant is that there's been almost no rental housing built anywhere in Canada in the past 30 years. So with the population of Vancouver increasing and buying becoming an impossible hope for most young people over the past, the big change was between 5 and 10 years ago where you just knew that they weren't going to be able to buy anymore. We have got this huge population pressing into a dwindling stock of aging housing. At the same time, we're dealing with big money that is flowing around the world and buying everything, specifically in the major cities. So we could see this coming. We could definitely see this coming 10 years ago. It had happened to New York in the 70s, to London, England in the 80s, when the teachers were being evicted and couldn't afford a place to live in London. We saw it happening in San Francisco in the 90s. And for some reason, Vision Vancouver decided to follow exactly the same model and produce the same results.
Thank you very much. I think your response was a little heavy on criticism, light on action. So what is it that you are going to do and push for on the city council in your next minute and a half? And why is that going to solve the problem?
In order to solve the problem, we have to look at the needs of probably the lowest 60% of income earners in Vancouver. With nothing green about moving your workforce out to the suburbs every day and dragging them back in. Vancouver's creating a heavy ecological footprint. We plan to ask the provincial government to allow the city to tax the 5% most expensive homes in Vancouver. At this point, that is homes that are valued at over $4.7 million, with a small surtax that will give enough that the city can have a ready annual stream to build housing for people who are never going to be able to afford it in this market, to rent at 30% of gross income.
Thank you. Jean Swanson, your turn. Why is Vancouver so expensive? What are you going to do on council to address the affordability problem?
So one reason that there's a lot of housing issues is because of really low welfare rates. Welfare isn't high enough to pay rent and eat. Another reason is because of uncontrolled speculation, not very high taxes on, not very high capital gains taxes on housing. And what we would like to do is a rent freeze, use every city power to prevent rent evictions, use every city power to enforce Section 23.8 of the Standards of Maintenance Bylaw so that slum landlords don't get away with virtually murder in the slum hotels. And we want a lovely mansion tax on houses worth more than $5 million. This is the assessment notice that we gave to Chip Wilson for his $75 million mansion. We figure that if we had this tax, we could get $175 million or so that we could immediately end homelessness in the first year with modular housing. In the subsequent years, we could build thousands of units of social and co-op housing for people and move up the income spectrum so that people who need housing get it. And in subsequent years, we could hopefully have enough money that we could start giving some land back to the three host nations, the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish.
Thank you. If I'm not mistaken, you said something about a rent freeze.
Yeah.
There is an issue of incentives. Judy, your opponent, mentioned the idea that we need more rental housing. The problem is the market doesn't want to build rental housing. It wants to build condos. If you install a rent freeze or any more draconian rent control than we have, do you not run the risk that nobody will even think about building rental rather than condo?
So we're focusing on non-market solutions. The market is the problem. with the housing, it should be a human right. It shouldn't be a commodity. So.
Well, hang on, I'm going to stop you. That's a good one, and I just want to engage on that for one moment with you. Who has a right to a home in Vancouver? Define the population that's entitled to a home in Vancouver.
The people who live here. Okay, so where was I? we think housing should be a right. So if a landlord... So I actually, before we did this rent-free thing, I looked on some real estate listings for apartment buildings for sale. And I looked at what their expenses... They have all the financials there, you know, how much they pay for the caretaker, how much revenue they get from the laundry, all this stuff. And I looked at, you know, 5 or 10 of them. And it looked to me like the revenue that landlords get from apartment buildings is about 1/3 of the of their costs. I mean, their costs are about 1/3 of the revenue. So I think for a rent freeze, they could easily absorb that, a 4-year rent freeze, and then we could reassess it at the end of 4 years, and I think it should be fine. And the other thing is, I don't know why people are always so worried about the poor landlords, what's gonna happen. They can always sell their building if it's too onerous. But we need to have people in City Hall who are worried about what's going to happen to the tenants, because the tenants are the ones that are being rent evicted. The tenants are the ones that are having their rents increase. The tenants are the ones that are afraid to complain about poor repairs because they're afraid of being evicted. And those are the people we need to stand up for.
Thank you. Pete Fry, again, the lead question is, why is it so expensive here in Vancouver, and what is it that you reasonably can hope to get accomplished on council?
Well, so, of course, Vancouver's expensive because we have a constrained land base. We're surrounded by sea and mountains. We're a very attractive city. We attract interest and finance from across the globe. So that has a profound effect on our thing, on our affordability. Now, there are other externalities, things like federal and provincial government. So, for instance, the federal government stopped putting capital gains tax incentives on the building of purpose-built rental in the 70s. That saw what was once the golden age of the 3-story walk-ups that we see throughout Kitsilano and the West End. They stopped building those because there was no more tax incentive to do so. On a provincial level, of course, it's the province that controls things like rent freeze. That's a Provincial Resident Tenancy Act issue. Things like property tax, as Judy mentioned, those are all provincial issues. So I know you've come up with some interesting proposals as far as like more towards a land value tax and really sort of recalibrating how do we assess property values, because the province sets the assessment and the property classes. So we have residential classes or agricultural classes. We don't have different residential classes. We just have one residential class, and that is applied through a mill rate by the City of Vancouver to whatever the province assigns. So what we can do as a city, my big thing is focusing on what we can actually do as a city. So first and foremost, we need to create a renter's protection office. We need a renter's office at the City of Vancouver to totally focus on the issues that renters face, liaise them with the provincial authorities, make sure that if there's rent evictions that are happening, that they're tying into building permits and development permits, and that we can catch people when they're doing unscrupulous landlord-type things. We need to have a moratorium on the demolition of purpose-built affordable rental for instance, in the West End, where we're seeing a loss of an incredible amount of purpose-built rental. We're not replacing it. People have nowhere to go. We have a major crisis unfolding. We need to loosen up the secondary suite bylaws. And most importantly, we need a citywide plan. This is the core to our whole Green Party approach, is we need a citywide plan. In the absence of a citywide plan, speculation runs rampant because we're looking at spot and discretionary rezonings.
Thank you. You mentioned, of course, property tax to a large extent and rent control are provincial policy. The feds have some taxing authority that's quite relevant. Tell me what your top wish list would be for the city's partners at the provincial and federal level.
Ooh, well, property tax reform in a big way. So moving more towards a land value tax where we really assess the value of land based on its best possible use. And we tax accordingly, because we actually subsidize a lot of inefficient land use, especially in a constrained land base like we have. The other thing is property transfer tax. So Hong Kong has a great system. They call it the 3D system. It's a 3-duty system. They have different duties that apply for, so on the flipping of properties, if you sell your property within 6 months or 12 months or 18 months, different increments of taxation apply, and that's on the property transfer tax. We already have that. The BC Business Bureau has been asking for this for years. So for flipping, for non-local capital investors, and for luxury properties, so sort of akin to the mansion tax. If we can apply those kind of tools to the kind of housing base that we have now and the property assessments that we have now, we could actually go a long way. And of course, the caveat being we need to make sure that those dividends are actually going to build housing and affordable housing for the people who live and work here. So we can extract more benefit, more public benefit from the developers. Up till now, the two dominating parties at City Council are receive a significant amount of financial contribution from the development industry. The Green Party is the only elected party that doesn't take money from the developer industry, and I think that's an important distinction when it comes to making appropriate land use decisions, especially when we're talking about people who benefit largely from those same land use decisions.
Thank you. Hector Bremner, the lead question is the same. Why is Vancouver so darn expensive, and what do you intend to propose to get things moving in a different direction?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for putting this event on, and thank you for all being here. We'll probably have a 10% voter turnout. So democracy is not just a political system. It is a responsibility, and it requires us to act. By you being here tonight, you're doing that, and I thank you for that. I have a formula, and I think there is a formula. It's not my formula. This is just evidence-based policy. If you want affordability and you want equity in a marketplace, it requires three things. First, you have to build the type. Right now, we tear down $3 million homes and we build $7 million homes. We prioritize the building of luxury properties, but try to get a duplex approved in 80% of the city. Two, volume. Yes, we do allow for some building. The government has done, after apologies and a decade of not acting, we've have a housing reset. But it's a reset for a couple neighborhoods and a couple streets. It's a tenth of what we need. Third thing, speed. It takes 2 years to get a building permit in this city. We are in the midst of a housing crisis. And my friends, if you are trying to build a home, if you want to build a duplex, you want to build an apartment building. 2 years. So here's the deal. If we miss any one of those components, any one of the three, we have inequity. We have housing unaffordability. We're missing all three right now. That's the situation we're in. We're playing musical chairs. Vision Vancouver and this mayor for 10 years have been running this town like a casino where people place their bets, but the house always loses. That is the situation we've been in. But we need to lean in. And we need to get away from the citywide plans and resets that simply exclude people from our neighborhoods. Because 40, 50 years ago, the West End, right here, where we live right now, we were building housing. We were building housing out throughout the neighborhoods. Where is it thriving? Maine, commercial. That's where the housing is. And then we stopped. We started excluding people from neighborhoods. We need to end the exclusion. And we can do that today.
Thank you. So a concern some people raise, and a lot of what you mentioned was on the supply side, and that is a lot of what's under the city's control, but what many people would say is there is a lineup of people from all over the world, very deep pockets, who want to come here to live for the amenity, and you can build all the condos you want. It doesn't have to be single family homes. You can build all the 1,000 square foot condos you want. They're just going to get snapped up by affluent people from
blaming
elsewhere.
The boogeyman's always great
and
politics.
You're not going to put
so
a dent
good.
In affordability. Yep. So yep. What is your response to that?
Oh, it's so easy to defend something or to, you know, blame something that is, you know, out in the ether, right? So easy to pick somebody that can't defend themselves and, you know, just attack that person, blame, point fingers. I've heard tonight is saying, well, it's the feds, it's the province. It's not, it's the city. 80% of our city. My friends, 80% of our city is closed for building middle-class housing. It's closed. So we need to start saying yes. Not saying, look, the boogeyman's coming to get us, because the federal government's numbers basically are, it depends on, you know, there's different markets analysis. You can say it's between 4 to 6% foreign ownership. But tell me then why. In Surrey, just last week, we cut the ribbon on the second only in 30 years purpose-built rental building, 97 units, 2,000 applicants. Was that foreigners? No, No, my friends, it wasn't. What we need to do is come together as a community and link arms and say, we're going to say yes to our future generations. Say yes to my sons that were born here, that live. We live right across the street. I don't know how my sons are going to live here. We need to lean in, say yes, and bring forward real concrete ways to do it. Ending piecemeal zoning, 99-year leases on city lands. Stop investing in communications people and start investing in our permit department. Fix the community consultation process and lead the region again. Make Vancouver the leader again. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll now turn things over to Margot for our next round of questions.
Great, and I'm going to begin now with Judy Graves, and then I'll work my way down the line and ultimately end up with you, Diego. The number of homeless in Vancouver was already too high, and yet it grew again last year, according to Vancouver's homeless count. The city of Medicine Hat has maintained a homeless-free status for 2 years. Is this attainable in Vancouver? And if so, how? Judy, over to you for 2 minutes.
You know, there's a difference between municipalities that solve homelessness and municipalities that failed to solve homelessness. And the only difference is that the municipalities that solve homelessness continue working on it until they're finished, right? There's no reason. The homeless in Vancouver are no different than the homeless in Medicine Hat. We have proven over and over and over again, and I've been here with you, and you've seen how we've proved it, that you can take someone from the sidewalk and house them. And as soon as you do that, you reduce homelessness. When we had housing for a brief little while for the homeless after the Olympics, we did a homeless count, and the numbers had gone way down. However, the numbers are back up because there is nowhere to put them. It's like musical chairs out there. There is nowhere. If I take Diego and I move him in tonight, Pete sleeps out. And the modular housing is wonderful. We're going to have 600 units of modular housing. We need probably about 4,000 units of modular housing right now. And if we had it, you would see homelessness disappear from Vancouver like that.
Thank you. Judy, I want to follow up with your comment about modular housing and actually expand it to ask about other specific measures that you see the city needing to implement, and perhaps also you could talk a bit about what you think the provincial government could do. But let me ask you that specifically about how one might get those 4,000 modular houses. What would the city do to do that? And are there any other concrete specific things where you on council you would push for?
There are many things that I want council to push for.
I mean, in relation specifically to the need to get people, as you say, off the sidewalks and into homes.
To get people off the sidewalk and into homes. Sorry. To get people off the sidewalk and into homes, we need homes to put them in. We need, as well, and very much within the ability of the city, we need to stop creating homelessness. We keep hearing excuses about where all the homeless are coming from. But I can tell you, one for one, where they're coming from. They're coming out of buildings that have not been maintained, or buildings that used to be occupied as the last barrier before homelessness, and have now been gentrified, and the very poor have just been tossed into the street, even though Vancouver has a bylaw saying that they needed to be relocated. That has not been enforced. The city has, I've been over the past few years over and over again in the residential hotels in the downtown east side, where I'm finding fire hoses tied month after month in the same knots like macrame. I'm finding wood rot running through the buildings, and that is work that is easy to repair, that is work that should have been done. The building should have been inspected and enforced on.
Thank you. Jean Swanson, it's your turn to answer the same question. Is it possible for Vancouver to reach a homeless-free status? And if it is, how would Vancouver achieve that?
So yeah, I used to work at the Downtown Eastside Residents Association in the 70s. And we worked on getting liquor laws enforced. We worked on getting the new standards of maintenance bylaw, the one that still isn't enforced. We worked on trying to get higher welfare rates. You know what we didn't work on? We didn't work on ending homelessness. And the reason we didn't work on it was because there wasn't very much. And the reason there wasn't very much was because in the 70s, the feds in the province were building thousands of units of social housing in Vancouver because welfare rates were high enough to pay the rent and eat, and because you could always get a room in an SRO that you could afford. Now, the feds in the province have basically stopped funding social housing. The city is promoting gentrification in the downtown east side, which is costing hundreds of rooms per year that push people out onto the streets. Some of those SRO rooms are renting for up to $1,400 a month now. And of course, welfare rates still stink. We can't end it'll be really hard to end homelessness unless welfare rates go up high enough so that people can afford to pay rent. So my solution is we need to get everybody off the street now. It's a life and death situation because homeless people have half the life expectancy as other people, and we need to do that with modular housing. The advantage of modular housing is it's fast and it's relatively cheap. But once those people get into modular housing, we're going to have to build decent social housing for them to transition into, and that's where we say we need a mansion tax so we can get the revenue to do that.
Thank you. Jean, you're running for city council, and yet you've talked a lot about some programs, the jurisdiction for which lies at the provincial level, so rent control, welfare rates. Can you elaborate a bit more on what you as a city councillor would do with respect to the issue of providing more modular housing and ensuring that you have the kind of social housing that provides a more permanent home for people to transition into after occupying modular housing?
So I want to be the type of councillor that opens up council to people that are working for social and environmental justice. No one person can do anything by themselves, but with lots of people behind you working with social movements, you can get a lot accomplished. For the last 12 years, I've been working at the Carnegie Action Project, trying to get housing, trying to get vision to go for housing, and it's like they're always saying, my hands are tied, it's a provincial responsibility, it's a federal responsibility, it is so frustrating. And then we say, well, why don't you just say, Gregor Robertson, that the amount of money that the province and the feds are putting into housing sucks. It's not nearly enough, it'll only build a pittance of units. And they say, oh, well, tell us what advocacy strategy we should use. And I make them a big long list of an advocacy strategy and they don't do anything, and it's very frustrating. You know, the city charter says that one of the jobs of council members is to advocate to other levels of government for what you need. And that's precisely what I will do if I'm in council. We have to have a kind of government that says what we need and fights for it. And if the other level of government won't do it, then we need them to give us the power so we can do it, which is where the mansion tax would come in. We need the power to tax mansions so we can have the revenue to get what we need.
Thank you. Pete Fry, you're up next with the same question. Is it possible for Vancouver to achieve a homelessness-free status? And if so, how?
Well, I know Vision Vancouver had promised that back in whenever it was, 2008, that they were going to end homelessness. It was a stupid promise to make because Vancouver can't go it alone. And we do need the senior government. And the only thing, you know, we had 10 years of unfettered Vision Vancouver. We also had like 15 years of unfettered BC Liberals who did a colossal failure on the housing file and has exacerbated the crisis that we see now before us. So Alone, we can't, but there are things that we can do. I think now we see a change in provincial government, and hopefully we'll see more investment. We saw the recent investment in modular homes, 2,000 units, not nearly enough. What we do know is that Housing First is a first is an actual part of the first step of getting people off the streets and into permanent housing. I've visited intentional communities in the States where I've seen it firsthand. People get four walls and a ceiling, and you know, at the Dignity Village down in Portland, after about, they have a two-year time limit. After about 6 months, they're actually stabilized enough. They have ID, they have jobs, they have the ability to move forward with their lives. So Housing First, modular housing, it's a great solution. We need more of it. But what the city can do is, first and foremost, our city, as we define affordability, the city of Vancouver's been defining affordability based on market, not on local income. So we need to actually fix the definition of affordability to local average incomes. And that can be the first step in really determining what kind of housing we build and where. And that's the power of the city, is to determine where we build housing. Now, the other big powers that the city have that they have been derelict on are the standards of maintenance bylaw. We have, you know, the Balmoral Hotel didn't happen overnight. That has been a long, slow-motion disaster unfolding. And we have the power, under the standards of maintenance bylaw, to apply a fine of $10,000 per offense per day. We haven't been doing it. The other big one we have to fix is the tenant relocation, which is the replacement for the rate of change bylaw. The tenant relocation, actually, there's so many loopholes, and it's so geographically specific that we're actually letting a lot of people fall through the cracks, and it's allowing for increased rent evictions, and we need to fix that right away. I'll keep standing, because you're going to ask me
something else. Yeah, I am. Thank you. So you mentioned Dignity Village. Can you tell us how Vancouver might achieve a similar kind of development, and what would be desirable about that for us?
Now, Dignity Village is more of an organic kind of thing. It was built out of a protest, and the city of Portland gave them some land up in northeast Portland where churches came in and they built little, you know, churches, and Habitat for Humanity built little huts and stuff like that. And it was very organic, but it was a very nice environment, and it was community-led. They had their own sort of rule sets, zero tolerance for thieves, but everything else was sort of like, they were very accommodating and welcoming of their fellow people. So that is an option, but I think here with what we're doing with the modular homes, it's really a matter of finding the locations. And I do think that one of the key factors to the success would be to locate not exclusively in the downtown east side. We've seen a hyper-concentration of a lot of this kind of service and housing in the downtown east side, and we need options for people outside of the downtown east side. So that was kind of Dignity Village. What made it work was the fact that it was two. There was the Right to Dreams and the Dignity Village. Right to Dreams is right downtown. It's more of a triage. The Dignity Village is well out of town, and it actually allows for a little bit more of a stable environment where you can see predators coming in.
So I'm just going to feed in one more question here. What would be your preferred policy on tent cities, then, to connect to the conversation about Dignity Village?
Well, frankly, I would prefer that we didn't have to have tent cities. I would prefer that we had housing for everybody. So to even comment on the tent city, I think a tent city is a response to a crisis, and we need to do better. I think the fact that we've allowed tent cities to thrive and haven't like jumped into action with more container I mean, these container houses are quick to build and easy to deploy. The fact that we sit and we watch tent cities, there was a tent city when I ran in 2014. It's not like tent cities are a new thing. And we continue to allow this to happen. And it's a failure of civic government. It's a failure of the provincial government. It's a failure of the federal government. So we need to step up our game on all three levels. And as Jean says, we need to really strongly advocate for that, as all of us, not just city councilors or city council candidates. All of us need to advocate
Thank
for that.
Thank you. Hector Bremner, I now turn to you with the same question. Can we achieve a homelessness-free status in Vancouver, and if so, how?
I certainly hope so. I've been homeless, and I know what it's like. I spent 3 years couch surfing. I lived at the mercy of a residential sort of manager. He would move us around from MTD unit. And, you know, we had a mattress on the floor and a red toolbox to sit on. And I know how hard it is to get out of that situation, to not have somewhere of your own. All the barriers are higher for you. Everything is more expensive for you. Deposits are more strict and higher. There's barriers to getting out of poverty. Sadly, the current plan just announced to supposedly end homelessness with some these modular housing units, which is great. I think it will make a dent. But the issue here is, you can just go a few SkyTrain stops away here to New Westminster, and you can see Columbia Street, where you had a deep, entrenched street, entrenched homeless population. It was kind of what, let's face it, the other downtown east side, I think is what it was called. And today, it's a thriving community. And the people that lived on the streets, they didn't go anywhere. They live right there. No barrier housing is what we need. What we're talking about with the modular houses, these are barriered. I don't believe for a second that we're going to take someone from the sidewalk who's been street entrenched homeless, who has mental health issues, who has deep drug addiction issues, who has their stuff, who has their pets, who has behavioral challenges and be dealing in a structured environment. All of those things will either preclude them from that housing, and once they're in there, they'll be punted out. And this is a deep, dark, ugly secret about homelessness. Is that we put these rules, we put our rules on people. We have to be where they're at. We have to go housing first, and we have to go no barrier, and only that, if we're to achieve it.
Thank you. So let me follow up then. You've described well the desperateness of the experience of being homeless. You've talked about a municipality that appears to have dealt with street-entrenched persons in a way that's responsive to their specific needs. But what concretely would you as a councillor want the city of Vancouver to do? For example, would you argue that the city should have some kind of anti-poverty strategy or other measures?
So if you look where it's been done, if we take evidence-based approach, I would say that as councillor, and I've been public about this, you can read all about it, as I am a housing first advocate. This is a very specific formula and a very specific way of approaching solving homelessness. I don't believe in any barriered housing, and I would fight any barriered housing that would be coming up in the city and mandate, I would like to see it mandated, that we go full on housing first. Get people housed. Let's make the investment. Let's work with the provincial government genuinely. And let's not just go to the media and do a photo op and say, oh, the province isn't doing the job. And then meanwhile, you were just in a meeting with them and sandbagging the conversation with zoning and, you know, silly rules and not really genuinely coming to the table. That has been Vancouver for the last 10 years, my friends. It really honestly has. I've been there at the table. My wife, who's here, who's my hero, she's worked on the front lines of this. It's a shame what we're doing. 30% in 3 years. 30% in 3 years. Seniors. $700 for a basement suite here just years ago. Now $1,700 a month. This is the crisis. The housing crisis is about business. It's about small business. It's about jobs. It's about our kids. It's about our seniors. But we will not end homelessness until we go full on, no barrier, housing first, and we have to say yes, no more barriers.
Thank you. Diego, you're the final person to address this question. Can we achieve homeless-free status in Vancouver, and how would we do that?
I think so. I think that it is important to believe that we can achieve it. It is unfortunate, of course, and I take ownership of that we couldn't achieve it by 2015, but having those goals, having that mindset to believe that we can end homelessness is important. I think it shows how committed you are to those issues. You know, nobody believed that we could do modular housing. Then, you know, the Vision Vancouver-led city council said, let's do it at Main and Terminal. Let's try 40 units. Let's prove that it can be a successful model. Now we have on the table money for 600 units of modular housing. I think that is a temporary solution so that we can house people safely. And, of course, introduce them to the kind of resources and support that they need to move into permanent social housing. Of course, we need to keep our eyes on the prize, which is permanent social housing for folks, absolutely. Just like the 40 that were able to move in into the existing units are now ready to move into permanent social housing. We have 1,000 new units of social housing coming online by the end of next year, but we need to absolutely do more. You know, as someone who lived off his mom's disability assistance while she was alive, I know that, you know, pushing for higher welfare rates, pension rates, disability rates are a big part of ending homelessness. my peers who transition out of care with me, many of them go on to become homelessness. So part of addressing the issue of homelessness is talking about the reality that a lot of the faces of the homeless population in Vancouver are former youth in care, are LGBTQ youth who need better transitions beyond the age of 19 so that they can have truly stable, vibrant lives. That we do need to advocate for more power so that we can introduce fines that are larger than $10,000 a day, that we don't have to wait 60 days. So I think there's a lot of advocacy that needs to happen, but also we need to continue to make investments on the solutions like modular housing.
Thank you. So you've talked about advocating for more powers for the city. What specifically would you ask for to have the power to do, and could you connect that to your claim about permanent social housing being the prize, as well as the need to deal with the poverty of youth and with youth who age out of care, and make it specific to what you'd like to see the city be empowered to do?
Yeah, I think obviously, like, we've been advocating, you know, the reality is that we've been advocating, the mayor has been advocating for specific powers since 2014 to help address the crisis, which is a crisis of enforcement, of powers, and of money that we need. Whether it is that, you know, we made it clear that we want to end fixed-term leases, the fixed-term leases loophole of the Residential Tenancy Act. We want to make sure that SROs, that the prices of a unit are tied to the unit and not to the person. We want to make sure that we don't have to wait 60 days for people, for landlords, for slumlords to make the reparations that they need to make. That there's some repairs that need to happen a lot quicker than that. We want to be able to impose fines that are way larger than $10,000 a day, because some landlords, believe it or not, can't afford to pay that, so they don't care. So we need to be able to introduce fines that are larger than that. And then to tie back to the second part of the question, how would that address the issue of homelessness? Because we need to make sure that housing is safe, that housing is clean, that it is a place where you want to stay most of the day. It is a place where you feel at home. We not only want to build housing for people, we want to build homes for people. And that means they have to be safe, they have to be clean, and it is somewhere where you want to spend most of your day in.
Thank you very much, candidates. And it's over to Tom for the third round of questions.
Thank you. And before we discuss our next round, where Jean is going to lead off discussing about density, I'm going to indulge something that I've always wished would happen in a debate. And I'd like to know who can be the first person to answer reasonably correctly. If you start with $125,000 invested at 7% interest, compounded annually for 20 years, $125,000 earning 7% compounding annually for 20 years, approximately how much money will you have after those 20 years? No calculators.
What?
No calculators.
You tell us.
Yeah.
I think you know.
Yeah, you tell us.
Nobody wants to give it a try? You're gonna have to study up. Post it on Twitter. We'll have a.
I'm gonna say you're gonna make about $200,000 off that.
$200,000 at the end of 20 years on the 125.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, great. Thought I'd try it. Interesting experiment. Okay. On to the question. Density. A part of the debate around housing focuses on issues of density. And this is for you, Jean, first. What level of density and where should the city allow it? In particular, address this issue, including a discussion of how regulations around development in traditional single-family home neighborhoods should be handled as the city thinks about rezoning. Should the entire west side be rezoned to allow townhomes and reasonably sized apartment buildings, or should the new density to create affordability be concentrated in close-in areas to downtown, like the West End?
So I've seen a lot of density in the last 12 years working at the Carnegie Action Project, where the city has allowed 17-story condo towers to wipe out basically a lot of the good parts of Chinatown, and where even the density from the downtown east side local area plan is gentrifying a neighborhood and pushing people onto the streets. There's one building, Sequel 138, for example, which is the Vision's perfect example of the type of housing that should be in the downtown east side, 79 condos, 9 units at welfare rate, and 9 at Hills, which is pretty high, unaffordable to local residents. And then every morning you walk, you go by, and there's people sleeping in every alcove of every store at the bottom. And so it shows that density doesn't work to house people that need it. And then other people like Hector is always saying we need supply, supply, supply. And Vision is saying we need supply, supply, and they're upzoning. And what we get is a whole bunch of housing that nobody can afford. And so we're thinking in my campaign that we want to concentrate on non-market housing, because that's the only kind that people who really need housing can afford. So yes, upzoning for non-market housing, yes. We had a practicum student at the Carnegie Action Project who is from Portland, a planning student, and he said, until I hung around you guys, I never knew there was a downside to upzoning. I love that quote. But the downside is when you have a lot of upzoning, you increase the rents for the stores and the residential places and all the places around them. So if you have upzoning without protecting the rental places surrounding it, you're going to be displacing people. So yeah, it really requires careful study when you start upzoning.
Thank you. I have 2 follow-up questions to that. The first is, I want to expand our discussion earlier of who's entitled to homes. So when somebody applies for an affordable housing unit somewhere in the city, as short supply as they're in, what is the precise eligibility criteria that you would define? Do you have to have been born in Vancouver? Do you have to have tried to make a go of it for some number of years? What is the eligibility criteria, 1? And 2, when you mention displacement, if we upzone the entire west side, a conjecture is single-family homeowners in Dunbar would not go homeless after selling their homes. What is the downside to adding housing supply in what are now single-family neighborhoods? And you think net socially, is that a positive or a negative thing?
So tell me the first question again.
Who's eligible
okay. For
affordable units in Vancouver? What's the definition?
So if I were the king or the queen, I would make the eligibility based on the need. And I would start with homeless people who are dying at half the age as other people. They would have the first priority, and move up the ladder to people who have really poor housing and need better housing, move up the income ladder, and try and do it that way so that, you know, pretty soon, if we got enough money from the mansion tax and the speculation tax and other things, we could start actually even buying land and having people home ownership based on leased land. And that would, you know, that would help a higher income level of person.
Have you sketched a costing of this, about what would be feasible, how many people could be housed, and would more people come in seeking this help?
Well, the standard figure for housing is, for a single person's unit, is $200,000 on city-owned land. So, yeah. So it would take a number of years to do it, that's for sure. And hopefully we would be advocating fiercely to other levels of government to put in their share, like they used to back in the 70s and 80s.
So one word, yes or no, are we allowing townhomes and condos blanket on the west side, or are we preserving single family?
You know, the problem with dividing up those units is it's just gonna be more revenue for the people that own it, because it's more density. So I would certainly be in favor of upzoning it for social housing.
Thank you. Pete Fry, the same question, and the spirit of it is, how important is adding density to affordability, and should the density be concentrated on thoroughfares in downtown,
Or is there a justification for preserving single-family neighborhoods where land might cost $20 to $50 million an acre?
Well, so part of that preservation argument, I think, has to factor in the inevitability of property tax reform. So land value tax, if we started moving towards a tax reform, then that single-family home land preservation makes more sense because it's accruing more value for the tax pool. I'm not in favor of a blanket, like, let's just rezone it all. I think that we need to have a little bit more of a sensitive, nuanced approach. Really big proponent, as Greens, we're really big proponents of, like, democratically empowering neighborhoods to take a grassroots approach to how we do that. So it's, you know, yes, that Jennifer Keesmaat, the former city planner of Toronto, had a great example about grow your city. And she had three different scenarios. It was one, and again, this was predicated by the tax form, the tax structure in Toronto, but they had three scenarios. Aging infrastructure, single-family home neighborhood, they had to upgrade it to pay for the infrastructure. So option one, leave it as it is, you pay the appropriate taxes. Option two, densify along arterials with gentle missing middle type housing, and that sort of offsets your taxes that way through that density. Option number three, take the town center intersections and build massive tower structures and that kind of thing. You have three options, pick your poison. Each one has its benefits and its drawbacks. And I think that's the kind of intelligent conversation we have to have when we move forward. But to Jean's point as well, I think that really when it comes to upzoning, we need to prioritize purpose-built rental housing. We need to prioritize non-market housing because right now we're at a crisis point with, and it's only getting worse. What we're seeing in the West End is massive potential displacement of some of our most vulnerable seniors. There's about 12,000 seniors in the West End who are literally being faced with the potential of being displaced, and we have nowhere for them to go. So we need to really start moving towards, you know, that as a solution. Like non-market housing has to be the priority.
Let me push a little bit on the West Side. Who do you envision demographically, you know, wealth, status, income, as the buyers of single-family homes on the West Side of Vancouver, separating out the laneway and the basement, but who is it who's going to occupy the owner unit that's the main house on a West Side lot 20 years from now?
As Jean suggests, rich people. Yeah, somebody who's got a lot of money. I mean, I think you certainly have the people who have been there and they are aging in their homes and they bought it in Vancouver. I mean, let's face it, Vancouver in the last 20 years has seen a stratospheric increase in property values that nobody could have ever imagined. And I think a lot of those people are house rich, cash poor, and we need to insulate them, and we don't want to create a whole new wave of resentment. And well, I mean, what are you going to do? Like tax them out and force them out of their homes? Oh, well, that's, you're cold-blooded, but
I'm not running.
Yeah, no. That's why we need a bit more of a nuanced and sensitive approach to that, I think, because there is a legit, I mean, these are people's homes that we're talking about, and even if they've, you know, benefited largely from that, I think, you know, we need to approach how we address that very sensitively. These are people, you know, this is how the whole idea of a citywide plan needs to unfold. We need to engage people meaningfully, not just force it. And by the way, that I was about half of what I suggested. It was 125, 200 in interest. So say more like 600.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay.
You're getting there.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Hector, your take on density, I think I know what it is. And I think the answer. So, A, how do we preserve amenity while building a huge amount in this city? A. And then B, I think I'm going to ask you to, off the bat, without work on the demand side 20, 25, 30 years from now, who's buying the condos that we're building today?
Okay, so you want me to answer?
I assume you're saying, yes, densify a lot. That is the answer. Yeah. But I think last time we engaged,
it's not the great foreign boogeyman that's coming to get your house. So if we build housing, it's not hurting neighborhoods. Cities grow or they regress, and that's unfortunate. We have, I think, I'm excited. I'm an eternal optimist. Anybody that knows me, I'm an eternal optimist. If you talk to, when I talk to friends in San Francisco, if you go and listen to their story, they say, you know what, 15 years ago, we wish we had just built, got over the neighborhood politics and, you know, got over this, the isolation, the nativism and the isolationism and building walls and, you know, putting red, wrapping our neighborhoods around red tape and you can't live here. Well, I'm an optimist that I don't think 80% of the city really agrees with that. I think that 80% of the city is now at a point where they're saying, the point was made around, we're house rich, we're cash poor, there's people like me whose kids were born in the city and they're wondering how their kids live here. I think that we can come together. I strongly believe this. Fix the broken consultation process, end the piecemeal zoning. Add the missing middle density across the entire city. Everybody needs to share the load. Right now, the current model is just dumping gasoline on the speculation fire, in fairness. And there is some fairness to the criticism to the building that we have been doing and the way that we've been doing it, because we do it, as I said before, the three components. We don't build the type, we don't build it at volume, and we don't build it fast enough. And so what we're constantly doing is chasing our tail. We're constantly playing this game of musical chairs, and we are always, always losing. And I'm solidly believing by the energy and momentum of our campaign, the amount of interaction with our messaging, the amount of people behind us on this effort, that people are ready to say yes and say, you know what, a duplex isn't going to ruin my neighborhood. And you know what, 120-foot mandated mansions in the west side probably doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think that some of the people who live there might be flexible and open. But we have to come together, and we have to say yes to each other. Thank you.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. you mentioned pre-zoning, I think, as opposed to spot rezonings. And I'd like everybody to think about this for my next round. The city makes a fortune on discretionary rezoning. So imagine you take a 12-unit rental building, double or triple the number of units, add millions of dollars in value to the property, many millions potentially. Why not tell the tenants, we're going to make you whole and then some. Each one of the existing tenants, we're going to give you $200K and you're going to get a place with, you know, you're going to get a $200,000 head start. The city's going to take half, two-thirds of the profitability and provide income assistance to people with low incomes. Who loses when you do that on a spot rezoning for cash? Or should the upside be done through a pre-zoning where the seller keeps all the upside because the zoning's already in place?
I think we all win when we take this optimistic approach and we get to yes and we say, what does yes look like? Let's say yes, and let's ask what yes looks like. We spend a lot of time in the city arguing over no. Sometimes the whole city council, all your city staff, millions of dollars of taxpayer money being focused on one building. We're arguing over one building or sometimes a tree or something. I'm referring to Langara West, of course. There was an argument over a tree, and a whole project died. So it is a city that is a growing, vibrant, amazing place. And we all came here from somewhere else, or our parents did. But I think now that we've got to admit that we have to be the welcoming city that we once were. My wife's family came here from the Philippines as she immigrated as a child in the early 1980s. When I talked to her mom and I talked to her brothers, who are older, I said, do you think you could pick Vancouver today? And they say no. So this is our challenge, all of us here in the room, to put aside the finger pointing and the blame and the, oh, my garden matters. We need to just come together, say yes. Let's discuss on ways that we can say yes and everybody can feel some sort of forward momentum. Instead of right now, what we do is we spend a lot of time saying no, and meanwhile, there's a lot of people in the shadows being left behind. I ask people all the time to think about the law of unintended consequences when we say no to things.
Diego, what do we do with our residential low-density neighborhoods in the city? I think recently we allowed, you know, actual stratification of some. Is a second unit enough, or should we disperse greater density, or do we build extreme density near downtown? Where does the new development go?
Right. Okay. So, you know, I think that it's very important to take the approach that there is not a one-size-fits-all solution for every single neighborhood in Vancouver. I think that we need to have conversations with neighbors and neighborhoods about how we balance heritage, how we balance character, and how we balance the needs of today's Vancouver, right? So in some places, that means the plan that I've put forward to allow to go from 3 to 6 units in single family lots. In some places, that means co-housing. In other places, it means low-rise towers. In other places, it means purpose-built rental buildings. But we need to have conversations with neighbors about what that looks like. We need to make sure that as we densify, so people can either downsize because their partner has passed away, their children have moved on, and they want to stay in their neighborhood, or like in my case, they're young people that want to live in those neighborhoods, that we have the housing that we need with the focus on affordability and, of course, social housing. So I've said that I will continue to support, and I think we should expand what we're doing at Oak Ridge, which is, you know, pre-zoning 20% of the units below market rates for people earning between $30,000 and $80,000. You know, as someone who comes from a low-income background, I would even support a conversation to say that it should even be lower than $30,000 to $80,000, and that's a conversation that we can have. I think all options are on the table with a focus on affordability and social housing, and how do we balance what we need in our communities, and that is, you know, the reality of density and making sure that people can afford to stay in Vancouver, but also the realities of people who want their neighborhoods to still be their neighborhoods, and we should listen to that as well.
Terrific, thank you. Let me go to your remark about inclusionary zoning and some of this pre-zoning. Suppose you've got a unit that can sell for $1.4 million in pre-sales on the market. I don't know what the value of a rental at affordable rents is, but I think you're essentially holding a lottery to get a unit that the market wants to pay $1.4 million for, and the winner of this lottery for the affordable unit maybe in present value is paying $400,000. Wouldn't it be more efficient for the city to take $800,000 from the developer, who now gets $600,000 instead of $400,000, and take that $800,000 and instead of giving it to one lucky lottery winner, distribute that money from all these projects to everybody deemed entitled to affordable housing? That is, are million-dollar lottery prizes a better form of income assistance than cash equally distributed to those eligible?
No, because I think that why we have this pre-zoning, inclusionary zoning policies is to ensure that there is affordable housing, while at the same time, my role as a city council is to make sure that people's incomes are also going up by a higher minimum wage, by an increase in welfare rates, by an increase in disability rates. So, no, I think that we need to ensure that there is housing that is affordable, that's attached to incomes, so that low and middle income people can live in it, while at the same time, right here, I'm advocating for higher wages for people and better supports that actually reflect the reality of Vancouver.
Thank you. Finally, Judy, densification. Will it work to improve affordability? Is it an important priority that Vancouver add more housing units? If so, what is the role of affluent single-family neighborhoods in being a source of added density?
Yeah. Of course, the city is going to densify. The city has to densify. There are ways of doing it and ways of not doing it that will be successful. Right now, we're building high density around SkyTrain stations. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense because the housing is so expensive that it is not really available to transit users. It might be an intriguing idea to build the housing, the tall towers that are built around transit stations with no parking under them, and see whether they appealed then to a different buyer. There is a neighborhood in Vancouver, specifically in West Point Grey, just a part of West Point Grey, not all of it, that is about a third of the size of the West End. The houses have been zoned so every house has to have 150 feet frontage and on an extremely deep lot. Each of these houses while they sell for what looks like a lot of money, actually sell for less than it would take to amass three or four East Side lots, East Side houses, to build condos or residential housing on. And I believe that that should be rezoned. You could build something a third of the size of the West End on land that nobody knows is there. Within the rest of the 80% of the land in Vancouver that is zoned for single family housing, we have to find multiple forms of zoning. Whether it will be successful or not is who that housing is targeted to.
Thank you. If the majority of this panel held sway over policy in Vancouver, it seems there would be a lot of help offered to people who struggle the most. What do you say to the middle-ish, maybe upper middle income families leaving Vancouver because the job opportunities are okay, but the housing's just too expensive? So what do you say to talented young people thinking of leaving Vancouver because there's not enough market housing big enough for their needs and wants, and so they're moving somewhere else? What's your message to a household like that?
Is that to me?
That's to you.
That was my own daughter. And young people are in a real crunch. If they cannot buy a house in Vancouver, and realistically, they're not going to be buying a house, even fairly good incomes. We can't attract professors to UBC. We can't attract teachers, librarians, nurses into the city of Vancouver. Young people's jobs don't have pensions attached, and they have to make decisions, and a lot of them are deciding to leave the city. It's a terrible loss to the city of Vancouver. It's going to make for a very strange-looking city over time. I believe that much of the rental that's being built now is actually being targeted to two good incomes. It certainly is not targeted to two moderate incomes.
Thank you. We now revert to Margot for round four.
Great, thanks. Well, we know that Vancouver is disproportionately, relative to other cities in the rest of Canada, a city of renters. So more than half of the households in Vancouver rent. I want to ask each of you the following question, beginning with Pete Fry. When you look at the Residential Tenancy Act and the Residential Tenancy Branch, granted these are matters within provincial jurisdiction, what legislative and procedural changes would you lobby the provincial government for? And then I want to ask a second part as well, relevant to the situation renters face in Vancouver. Similar to the tenant relocation and protection policy, what are the things that the city of Vancouver itself, apart from lobbying the provincial government, what are the things that the city of Vancouver itself can do to enhance the rights of tenants beyond the scope of lobbying for changes to the Residential Tenancy Act? Two changes, really, some specific legislative pieces at the provincial level, and then really some concrete ideas of what the city already has jurisdiction to do with respect to the situation renters in Vancouver face.
Yeah, so to the provincial issue, I think probably lobbying to end fixed-term leases and to really focus on a more transparent rent control. I'm not really sold on the idea of a rent freeze per se. I'm not sure that's a tenable thing. Certainly we've seen what just happened in Ontario, where they initiated a rent control, rent freeze kind of scenario, and the developers of purpose-built rental housing just pulled out altogether. So unfortunately, in a market-driven economy, that's the kind of gamble that we have to take with that kind of thing. So it needs to be measured. Obviously, the landlord lobby has a pretty powerful voice provincially, and when we talk about 89 MLAs, getting them all on board with anything is going to be a challenge. So I do think that we need to strengthen the provincial legislative approach. But of course, I'm running for city council, so really my major focus is what we can immediately do, and that's one of the reasons we call for the creation of a renter's office. When it comes to standards of maintenance bylaw, obviously we've let that go on a lot of properties. When it comes to the tenant relocation bylaw, I think there's a lot of room for improvement there because it's actually it doesn't cover the entire city. It's actually quite geographically limited to just certain areas. It only handles purpose-built rentals, so it can't handle any of the secondary kind of properties or condominiums for that matter. Now, 30% of all Vancouver renters, so 55% of Vancouverites rent. 30% of those people are renting in private condominiums. And when you consider, so when we talk about rent control even, when we talk about like private condominiums, we've had two interest rates already go up this year. We're probably going to have a third one go up this year. How do we manage the property owner's expectations of a return if they're on a variable mortgage or what have you? How do we manage their expectations? How do we manage so we don't end up with even more evictions as a result of some ill-conceived policy? But we do definitely need to strengthen the relocation bylaw. Did I get that?
Great, thanks. And I think we've got a point that we're going to hear some different opinions on with respect to the desirability of a rent freeze and the impact of the market on condos from our other candidates. But Pete, don't sit down yet, because I do have a follow-up question for you.
So.
Canada's quite unique in that over 90% of our housing is delivered through the market. You talked a bit about market pressures on landlords with respect to rental properties. What would you do either to change or to in somehow address the fact that we're so market-driven in our housing provision?
Oh, yeah, and that's the problem. We are tied to the market-driven economy, and I think that's really robbing our whole society of that sort of tenure that, you know, I think all the substandard housing that we deal with, all the issues of homelessness, the federal government got out of building housing in 1993, and that's when all, you know, I remember prior to 1993 feeling smug going down to the States and thinking, we don't have homeless people like they do, and wow, look at how much things changed since 1993. That, in the nutshell, is the root of our problem, the fact that the federal government got offloaded the building of purpose-built social and rental housing, affordable housing. The feds got out of the biz. They passed it off to the province. They shortchanged it. That is the nut of the crisis. We need to get the federal government, we need to get all levels of government back into the building business of building public housing. And, you know, I think there is an opportunity for us to extract some of those benefits from the private market. We do have a lot of private development. I think we should be more resourceful and strengthen how much we extract in public benefits. So when it comes to things like Whistler Housing Authority has a great model where they actually, you know, it's a resort town, they build a lot of housing for people who are coming there to ski for the weekend, but every housing build has a 20% mandated local housing extraction. And that is owned by the city of Whistler, and it's either resold or it's rented out to local workers who were previously living in trailers and camping in tents because they didn't have places to live. And that's, you know, a proactive approach to solving the problem. But I think that's where we have to start looking.
Thank you. Hector Bremner, you're up next, and I'm going to ask you to answer the same question with respect to residential tenancy policy at the provincial level, but also specifically at the municipal level. And can you begin with telling us whether you would say yes or no to a rent freeze position being taken by the Vancouver City Council?
So I spent some time in Victoria. I got to work, and I was actually assistant to the minister responsible for housing. I was actually the guy, I actually got to be responsible for the Residential Tenancy Act, the Strata Act, and BC Housing for issues. So issues would come to me, and I would kind of be Hector the connector and fix things. So what I saw was a really interesting two universes, right? There's the renters, and the renters are like, oh, the landlords are getting all the favors. And then you talk to the landlords, and the landlords are like, oh, those guys are, you know, the act is so heavily leaning towards the renters. And I think that, you know, this dichotomy is going to continue to exist. I don't think it's a conversation that will ever go away. I think there's some, at the provincial level, things I was very disappointed that the fixed-term lease wasn't ended fast enough. I think those items are extremely important. But the reality is, and as well, I think the Strata Act needs to be addressed, the fact that we allow stratas to prevent owners from doing long-term rental in their units. And I think we can also do some things at the provincial level within the Strata Act to address Airbnb. The other, Ontario did this. This is was highly successful. But I think if we're really truly to create tenant balanced market, just recently in Sydney, Australia, they added 30,000 new units. 30,000 new units of rental. You know what's happening right now when you rent an apartment in Sydney? they will give you an iPad if you'll sign just a one-year lease. So you can see that while some folks believe that only a non-market-based approach is the solution, it's pretty clear that the market-based approach can work. But we need to, first of all, address why we restrict the building of apartments and rental, why we restrict housing building. Sorry, I'm going to go over time. It's a very, very complex issue.
Okay, great. Well, let me follow up. So we've just heard you say that you were a political aide with the provincial government working on these issues around housing. Can you tell us what you think the legacy of the provincial Liberal government is with respect to housing? And then I'd also like to hear a bit more about what Sydney did to enable market-based housing to result in the situation where landlords are enticing tenants with iPads. So first question, legacy of the provincial Liberal government, and the second question, more details on the measures that Sydney put in place.
Yeah, so here in Vancouver, we restrict the building of housing. We take 2 years to give you a permit. A financier, a bank, will never give a builder a loan to do the land assembly anyways. The piecemeal zoning is just this cascading series of speculatory costs compounding on top of one another. There was the famous $11 million home on the Cambie corridor, Cambie and 35th. Just a tear-down rancher. It's not a mansion, just a tear-down rancher, $11 million. The legacy that's important to discuss here tonight, the legacy that's important to discuss is what's been happening in the city, the people that's been running the city for 10 years.
So you're not going to answer
the question about the legacy
of the provincial
government?
When
are we going to start passing the buck to the province? When are we going to start passing the buck to the province and say, what are we doing in our city? Why do we not allow, if you don't like the provincial government, the previous one, that's fair. That is a fair thing. You don't have to agree with them.
So you know what? Let's let the candidate finish his speech. He's had the questions asked to him, and we want to listen to his answers.
So what's important to remember is that we've had a government for 10 years in the city of Vancouver. They have been responsible for housing policy. They have been responsible for building housing in the city. They are the ones that have been dealing with it. And
please,
we want to pass the buck and keep on twisting ourselves into a pretzel to not believe that we are in the midst of a housing crisis that is of our own making at this level, right here. And I firmly believe 80% of Vancouverites out there right now, they're out there, and they are passionate believers that if we come together, that we can build the housing that we need, that we can bring equity back to this market, that we can do the things that we do on an evidence-based policy, but partisanship and division is not going to be a solution.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And I just want to caution the audience to please let the candidate speak uninterrupted. Okay, I'm now going to move to the next candidate, Diego, and I've got the same question for you about renters with respect to provincial policy around residential tenancy law and then also policy at the municipal level specifically.
So, yeah, I think, if elected, I will continue to advocate that we end the loopholes in the fixed-term leases, that we put an end to illegal rent evictions. I would also continue to support our call that if you are indeed evicted because of a rent eviction, you should be allowed into that unit at the same price you were paying before the rent eviction. I would advocate for that. I do not think a rent freeze goes far enough. I think a rent freeze on its own is only a freeze on the building of rental housing. But we can do it. I would support it, provided that we switch the tax incentive so that we encourage the building of rental units instead of condos. If we can get the federal level government to follow up on its promise to waive the GST on the building of rental housing, then I do support a rent freeze, if that's the case, provided. I would also advocate that the residential tenancy branch provide services beyond 9 to 5 p.m. because people who just can't make a call to the residential tenancy branch between 9 and 5 p.m. can get access to it. I would also provide that we have multilingual services for the residential tenancy branch. It's a reality in Vancouver that a lot of folks do not speak English, not just as a third language, they just don't speak English. So we need services that are not just in the English language. At the municipal level, I've also committed to creating and championing a renter's advocate at City Hall to help people fight illegal rent evictions. I want that advocate to have multi-language services that go beyond 9 to 5 p.m. That's my commitment. I've also said that I would use the funds from the empty homes tax that's been incredibly popular with the citizens of Vancouver for very good reasons, because there's just homes sitting empty, to put it into the Vancouver Rent Bank so that we can renew funding for the Vancouver Rent Bank and continue to prevent homelessness that way.
Thank you. So let me ask you a follow-up question about two aspects of your answer. So given the almost full concentration of housing provision in the market in Canada, unlike, for example, say the United States or other countries similar to Canada, how would you ensure that a rent freeze wouldn't discourage purpose-built rentals? What would you do in the context of imposing a rent freeze or significant rent control to encourage more rental residential property being built at the expense of that property simply being built as to own condos?
Can you repeat the last part of that question so that I make sure I got it? So in the case that I do support...
We're heavily dependent upon the market to provide residential...
Perfect, no problem.
...property right
got
now.
It. So, like I said, I would support a rent freeze if we have incentives, tax-based incentives that promote the building of rental housing. That's why I don't currently support it in its current format, right? Because building condos is just more profitable than building rental housing. Unfortunately, that is the reality, and we need to switch that reality. And if we can switch that reality, then I would be supporting a rent freeze. I think it's not rocket science what we need to do in order to encourage the building of more rental housing. Is that we need to waive that GST so that we can allow the market to build rental housing, but still continue to look at the options that we have at the city level, which is to continue to provide city-owned land to build affordable and social housing. We have the first Vancouver Community Land Trust that deliver social housing units, so we need to mix them both, absolutely. But a rent freeze can only happen if we have that switch in the tax code.
Thank you. Judy Graves, so the same question to you about provincial policy with respect to residential.
Your mic echoes over here so that I can't pick up the words.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what do you want to see? You can answer from there.
Sure. So if you could give me the question.
I most certainly can. Can you hear me well now? It's not echoing. So I began the question by noting that more than half of the households in Vancouver are renters, not home owners, and that some policy that pertains to rentals lies significantly with the provincial government, the Residential Tenancy Act, the Residential Tenancy Branch. What changes would you as a city councillor advocate for the provincial government to implement with respect to its laws regarding residential tenants? And then the second part of the question is, what would you want the City of Vancouver itself to do to deal with the low vacancy rate, the high rents that renters in Vancouver currently face?
Okay. Well, first, of course, with the Residential Tenancy Act, we have to get rid of that one-year lease. That's crippling people and leading to astounding rent increases. We need to end the rent evictions. It should be the same as if a person is living in a condo. They wouldn't abandon their condo because the condo is being rewired. You know, you'd go stay with a friend for a couple of days, you'd move back in. The rent evictions have to end. with the province as well, there needs to be changes to the legislation governing pets in apartments. And we need to be more civilized, somewhat like they are in Quebec, like they are in Ontario and Portland and many other cities, so that landlords are not forbidding pets in apartments. I would additionally advocate with the provincial government an increase to the Safer Seniors Rent Supplement, because the supplement is so low now that it is leaving seniors unable to afford to eat. There are seniors all over the West End crying themselves to sleep at night because they have absolutely no way of knowing where they're going to go. And what would I have the city do? Immediately to change the available rental would be enforcing on Airbnb, where we have entire buildings taken over by Airbnb, and even now the smaller condos are being, the condo, whole building, taken over by Airbnb.
Okay, well, I have a follow-up question for you, so don't go away yet. Would you support the City of Vancouver Council adopting a policy urging the provincial government to freeze rents? And can you also talk about what your answer to that question would mean for the market pressures around the provision of purpose-built rental property? So given that we are so market-dependent in our provision of residential property, how do you encourage the market to build rental as opposed to home ownership property?
With all my heart, I understand the desire for a rent freeze. I don't think in the end it's going to be effective. I think that right now what we need is to get rental stock, to get back the housing that's been taken by Airbnb, to get stock that is being built quickly and targeted to young people, to get stock that already exists and could be rented by students. And I think of those houses along Cambie that are standing empty, awaiting demolition. Every piece of housing in Vancouver is precious and needs to be used. But right now, just building something is not going to help. We have to be building targeted at an affordability that is reasonable for the seniors, that is reasonable for the families, that is reasonable for the people who earn average and lower incomes in Vancouver. And I think a rental freeze might well get in the way of that.
Thank you. So, Jean, you're up next, and you have the same first question, speaking to residential tenancy law at the provincial level, and then also to what the City of Vancouver ought to do itself within its own jurisdiction to deal with the crunch our Vancouver renters face.
So many things. So how to change the, what the province should do, and the fixed-term lease, and the 4% increase, and the put rent control on the unit, not the tenant, bring in a rent freeze. I'm glad that our call for a rent freeze is at least setting the question agenda. And I don't agree that rent freeze would be, that in order to have a rent freeze work, we'd have to give a tax loophole to landlords. That would just be giving foregoing government revenue so landlords, people who are rich enough to buy apartment buildings, can enter the speculative market with housing that's going to appreciate in value with no control. I think people who have had a lot have been threatening people who don't have a lot for a long time, and it's time for us to call them on it and stop caving into that. We need, the RTA needs to be changed so that all buildings can be pet friendly. We need better and free access to the residential tenancy branch. What can the city do? It can fund tenant organizing. So folks in the West End who are getting intimidated by their landlord, and they're afraid to talk about an elevator that doesn't work in a building with 11 stories, and about bathrooms that don't work, and about leaks, and they're afraid to call about it because they're going to get evicted, so that they could get organized and fight back. We need funding of tenant organizers. We need enforcement of Section 23.8 of the Standards of Maintenance Bylaw, where the city goes into the slum buildings and does the work and bills the landlord. And when the landlord doesn't pay, the city can put it on the taxes, and if he doesn't pay the taxes, the city can take the building and we've got more social housing. The city needs to work on getting nonprofit management in SROs that aren't being run properly.
So, Jean, you've had the red card.
Oh, okay. But also end rent evictions at the city level.
But I do have a follow-up question for
okay.
you. Okay. So let me give you that, and then the floor is yours again for the next minute and a half.
Go.
You talk about a rent freeze being a policy the city of Vancouver should urge upon the provincial government. So I ask you the same question in light of the fact that we're so market dependent for the provision of residential property, of housing. How would you deal with the argument that a rent freeze is essentially a disincentive to any new rental housing being built?
I'd call their bluff. I've looked at the finances, right? Landlords are making a lot of money. They can handle a rent freeze. I'd call their bluff. And rather than give them a tax incentive, I'd use the money that would go into that to build more social and co-op housing. We have to start making a stand here, folks. We can't have housing in the speculative market. We've got to get housing as a human right, not a commodity. And that means we have to have publicly owned land, nonprofit owned land, build housing on it that doesn't appreciate in value, and that's where I'm going to put my energy if I'm elected.
Thank you. So, Tom has the last round of questions for our candidates.
No math question this time. not exactly math. Anyway, I think my first question goes to Hector, and Gene Swanson, like Vision, has proposed that we ought to have, and I think Pete as well, higher tax rates on higher value properties. Currently, the city did get permission from the last government to have the tax on homes where nobody's home. Do you support those two measures? Do you think they're sensible demand-side measures? And then, maybe that's half your answer, the other half, generally speaking, when you think about one way of raising revenue versus another way of revenue, what are better ways for governments to raise revenue, and what are worse ways for government to raise revenue?
Well, thank you. And overall, I would say, if I'm understanding the question entirely, is that in Ontario, just not long ago, they had pretty tough rental rules put in place, more market inclusions. I wouldn't say rent freeze, but there was certainly a toughening of the act. And 28,000 units were on the books for purpose-built built rental in the province.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking those.
No, I know. So this is a segue. So the point here is that now we have 22,000 of those units now being converted to condos. We see through that example that through effective taxation, rules, regulations, we can incentivize or disincentivize certain behavior. So this is correct. I think there is a fairness to say that certain properties per capita and per square meter are paying a lot less tax. It doesn't make a lot of sense that obviously a big mansion is paying per capita a lot less tax in terms of real property tax in the west side, when on the east side of town, a middle-class family or people just trying to get by are paying per capita much higher. That's not equitable and that's not fair. And I think there's a really powerful need right now for us to have that conversation. And I think once we really, truly begin to address the end of the piecemeal zoning, ending of the neighborhood-by-neighborhood battles that will end up, have sort of marked the last 10 years. I think that we can get past that. And I think we can see that as a revenue opportunity for our cities. I think we can see that as an opportunity to strengthen our community centers, our infrastructure. We haven't talked about transit tonight at all. And one of the biggest barriers for us to live the, I'm lucky, I live across the street. We're a family of four, I have no car. But I'm able to live this intermodal life where I can choose to get out of my car. I don't have a car at all, but I can walk, I can take transit, I can walk. But these are all things that are paid for through a more effective building and zoning planning and tax models.
Yes. Okay, so let me build on one thing you said and ask for a clarification on the other. So the empty homes tax, support, not support, and then B, do you think the subway line to Vancouver, to UBC, would pass a cost-benefit test?
So on the first question, the empty home tax, I've had a few people point out to me that they're Canadians, they're seniors, they're people like my parents who will travel for part of the year. And under this tax, the law of unintended consequences in governing is actually could be applied in some cases to folks like that. And there are some real serious concerns about it. But I do think, yes, whatever we can do to disincentivize the empty homes is great. The best incentive, the only reason the speculation in the empty home exists and why it's treated as so-called a commodity is because we don't build a large amount of supply. We keep on playing the other guy's game. We keep on running it like a casino, but the house always loses. And that has been strictly related to the fact that we restrict supply. We constrain it, we exclude ourselves for it, and we allow other people to come into the market and basically outbid us, and then yes, they will hold a property. The second part of your question was the Broadway SkyTrain line. Would it pass a cost-benefit analysis? Probably not, given to just it's going to Arbutus, right? I mean, I personally believe that we probably could have done it differently. There was other choices that we can make, and I think that's a fair conversation to have. But I think that if we're going to build it, let's find a path to getting it to UBC then and truly make it effective. And I believe UBC is willing to come to the table on that.
Great. Thank you very much. Diego, the main question in this round is Gene Swanson, and I believe your party's mayor have proposed higher property tax rates on higher value properties. Also, the empty homes tax has come into play. Given your party has supported both of these, I think maybe the more sophisticated question is that too much meddling into the private market? Shouldn't people be able to make their own decisions about what they do with their properties, A? And then B, what is your framework, generally speaking? If you hear a new tax introduced or a tax cut, when are taxes a good idea? When are they the right way to raise revenue? And when do you think taxes need to be lower because they're the wrong way to raise revenue?
So, yes, the mayor has called for a progressive property tax, progressive land tax to raise revenues. In 2014, there was the first letter that was sent to Christy Clark calling for what you might also translate to a speculation tax or a luxury homes tax. We do very proudly support the empty homes tax that the MPA has opposed consistently. And I think the idea is, some of these taxes, like progressive property taxation, the idea is to raise more funds so that we can invest on affordable housing, on social housing. The idea of the empty homes tax, the Airbnb regulations, is that we can change behavior, right? We want to increase the rental stock. The main purpose to address the first part of your additional question is, of course, to increase the rental stock and to change behaviors, because properties cannot be treated as a luxury. They cannot be treated as a hotel in the mix of a crisis. But if we do raise funds, like I think we're going to raise from the empty homes tax, I propose clear things that we should do with that money, like funding the Vancouver Rent Bank. And I think we should use it for other affordability measures like transit and also creating more childcare spaces. On the second one of when are taxes bad, when are taxes good, I think progressive taxations is always good. There is never a wrong time to have progressive taxation, that we all contribute to the best of our ability, and that we all contribute based on what we earn and what we get back from the social investment of all of us paying for the social goods that we all access on a daily basis.
Thanks. I want to go back to the rent freeze from the last round. Many people have bought property here in the not too distant past under a belief that Vancouver's a terrific market where it's hard to build, and the appeal of Vancouver's only going to get greater over time. A lot of them are highly leveraged and not necessarily rich people, but they leveraged themselves, bought an investment property. What's wrong with rents growing a little bit faster than inflation? Why is it that a tenant who is not taking the risk of a property value decline needs to be protected from rents growing at inflation, maybe plus a little bit?
So I think that it's very important that we don't divide ourselves between, you know, landlords contribute more to our city than tenants. I think it's very important that we don't get into that language of division that our opponents often like to point out. You know, I think tenants contribute as much to the city as landlords. We both depend on each other. It is a cycle. One cannot exist without the other. I think it is important that when we look at rent, we got to put it in the context of everything. So I said that I do support a rent freeze, given the changes on the tax code incentives, on the GST waiving, because the reality is that, you know, you can have rents that go up beyond inflation when wages are not keeping up at that pace.
Sorry, let me clarify. Yeah. Are you talking about a real freeze that is inflation adjusted, or are you talking about a nominal freeze that you would support?
No. I'm talking about the rent freeze conversation that we're having
yes,
right now.
Nominal
that I would
or inflation adjusted, frozen?
Regardless of what it is in detail, I've said that I would only support it if we have the changes to the tax incentives. If that happens, then we can have a conversation about which option we go for. But if we don't have those changes ahead of time, we can't even have that conversation. Yeah. Now, to go back to answering your final question, you know, wages are not keeping up, welfare rates are not keeping up, disability rates are not keeping up, former youth in care, current youth in care, certainly our supports are not keeping up. So we gotta make sure that, you know, rent is not going, it's not going above the roof in terms of increases, because it's not a reality with the rest of people's lives.
Thank you. Judy, to you now, and the main question for this round is where you stand on the mansion tax and the empty home tax specifically, and then philosophically, what guides your view of where revenue ought to be raised from? Property taxes, income taxes, sales taxes. What are the right sources of revenues, and what are the wrong sources of revenues, generally speaking, around the Lower Mainland?
Okay,
what's good tax policy and what's bad tax policy?
We already have progressive income tax policy, and that's a federal tax. Poor people do not pay as high a percentage of tax as wealthy people. Poor people in the city do not own housing. So we're talking about already a privileged class. It's the only privileged people now that own housing, people who have choice. And I do respect that people bought housing way back and bought a house for $35,000 and struggled to pay for it. But that generation is leaving us. And it's a generation still that, because the property value went up so much, they have choices. When we look at people who bought a mansion and sold it 5 years later for a profit of $18 million, that's probably more than most of us will make over the course of a lifetime from very hard work. And that was passively earned money, money that was earned, money that came to them because of a confluence of factors that happened to Vancouver where they had bought the house. I think it is fair to tax that money as part of a progressive tax. I think it is fair to tax the vacancy. Yeah. I think that when we started tonight, there was a statement made about being on the unceded territory. Yeah. And the people whose territory we are talking about tonight are sleeping on our streets. And when we're talking about fair, that's where I'm coming from.
Terrific. Thank you. A follow-up question I have relates to gentrification. Is gentrification all bad? And let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose on city-owned land, you could build a tall building full of units on which the city makes $1 million apiece. So potentially $1 billion in revenue from these 1,000 units. Is the best way to support people struggling with low incomes to have the thousands of people eligible for assistance in this city come and participate in a lottery for those 1,000 units? Or should the city sell at market, take the $1 billion, and help everybody eligible? That is, dedicated affordability units, or profit from the interest in our community, market housing units, take the wealth, spread it evenly among those in need.
Okay, that's a bit of a fake question, okay? And I'm not gonna buy into it. There's never one building gentrifying an area. You know, you'll get one building, and then, as for instance, when they developed Woodward's, the weekend that they sold the yet unbuilt units for Woodward's in that beautiful giant condo, that happened on a Saturday. On the Monday, I walked down Hastings, and every building across the street had a for sale sign, had gone up on it over that weekend. All of those buildings have gentrified. All of the artist studios have moved out. All of the housing for the poor has been displaced. There is no poverty there. And the poverty has been pressed eastward, been pressed south. It's being pressed north, and these people are being squeezed out. Gentrification invariably displaces unless it's done with real intention.
Thank you. Jean Swanson, you've proposed the mansion tax, and the city has empty homes tax in place. I presume you support both, but what would you say to people who say broad intervention by government, the heavy hand of regulation, is exactly what's prevented our city from creating enough housing units to have meaningful affordability for working families?
I would say that they're wrong. The reason we don't have affordable housing is because we've had 40 years of austerity. We've had 40 years where three levels of government have cut back the taxes on the rich and cut back the programs and the services for the poor. That's why we're in this crisis. And I was just thinking of Tommy Douglas, because you asked me about what about the landlords who will threaten that they won't build any more houses. You know, the doctors told Tommy Douglas that if he brought in socialized medicine that they'd all quit. And he called their bluff, and because of that, we all can go to the hospital for free.
Okay, well, terrific. Let me ask a follow-up on that. I think the idea that developers would go on strike, given that they're lining up around the block to get permits, is indeed a bit of a stretch. But what developers can do is decide not to build rental units and instead to sell condos. Some condos become rental units themselves, but purpose-built rental and condos converted to rental surely become less attractive when the condo hasn't fallen in value, but the rental unit now has frozen rents. Let me ask, A, do you mean nominally frozen or adjusted for inflation frozen? And B, don't you think there would be fewer units dedicated to rental and more to condo if landlords could not expect to see any increasing dividends on their investment?
Okay, so we're calling for a 4-year rent freeze to be reassessed at the end of that, and then we picked 4 years because that's about the end of the provincial government's term. So 4 years, it's not that much money. When you're talking about landlords not building money because they're getting a piddling little amount of money less than they would if they didn't have the rent freeze, I think it's very, very hypothetical. We're saying tenants are paying over $2,000 a month for one bedroom. They can't afford to live here. Grown children are staying with their parents. We know everybody's moving out. Homeless people are sleeping on the streets because rents are so high. This is a crisis. We need a solution that's comparable to the level of the crisis. And the solution that we're proposing is a rent freeze. And yes, it would take some guts to do that. But that's what we need in this situation. We need guts. The other question you asked was, what would our position be on how taxes should be set? So I would say taxes should be set progressively. The rich should pay more than the poor. And federally, even that doesn't happen much because there's so many loopholes. But I just want to add one thing. If Chip Wilson sold his mansion, there'd be enough money there to build 375 units of social housing, good social housing.
Thank you. Pete Fry, I believe this is the last of all of our questions. It's going to sad farewell. Gene's got the mansion tax. Vision has had it in the past. Empty homes tax now in place. Were these the right asks of the provincial government? Or what would be better taxation policy for Vancouver to ask from the province?
Well, I don't think the empty homes tax is that effective. And I'm not just blowing smoke, buddy, but some smart guys, a bunch of smart economists and professor types came up with the idea that we should front load property taxes pretty high and then really collect them back on income tax. So it sort of captures a lot of the foreign investors. It captures a lot of the wealthy people. So in effect, it would be a mansion tax. It could also catch the kind of empty homes tax. But I think the empty homes tax as an idea can probably pretty easily be gamed. If you have enough money to have a house that you keep empty, you could probably figure out a way to make it seem occupied for 6 months out of the year. It doesn't seem that complicated to me. I think you'd be relying on snitch lines. It would be a very imperfect system. But the idea of really front-loading, really adding some onerously heavy property taxes that then you'd collect against your income tax, that's a workable idea. And I think that's a fair idea because it's really tied to your income and it works for all Canadians. And if you're not collecting income tax here, if you're not paying income tax here, well, then you don't get that discount. And that sort of covers that element. But that's really a provincial issue. I think another strong provincial tax tool is property transfer tax. As I mentioned earlier, the Hong Kong system, triple duties, one for foreign investors, one for speculating flippers, and one for luxury properties. That's the kind of thing we can leverage because a property transfer tax is every time a property is sold. So if you don't sell your property, it doesn't really apply to you. And it's a great revenue generator for the province since it was introduced. On a civic level, though, there's, I think, a couple of things that we could really assertively do. One is to lobby the province to change our property classes so we can have a little bit more flexibility with how we assign property classes. I'm thinking specifically of local small business because a lot of them are really suffering. There's this whole idea of split assessment. So if you have a little mom and pop shop, but you happen to be zoned for a 4-story condo above, you're paying taxes on that basis. And that's what's killing our small business things. And I know I'm out of town, but I want to talk about tax increment financing because I know that's something you'd probably really dig. especially with regards to transit-oriented development, so maybe if my next question can steer me that direction.
I think we may be able to. So let me ask you this question. The city has a big parcel of land, and it can build 1,000 units. Do you prefer A, hold a lottery, all the eligible low-income households show up and hope they're one of the thousands to get the units, or should the city build them at 400,000, sell them for $1.4 million, $1 million times 1,000 is $1 billion. Would you prefer A, the lottery for the units, or B, sell them at market and use the billion for something else? And if so, where does the billion go?
See, I'm not really an A-B guy. That's why I was segueing into the tax increment financing. So the idea about tax increment financing, and it's really popular in the United States, I've seen how it works. In places like Portland and stuff, they take a location, like for instance, along our future Broadway subway line, let's say. If it went all the way out to UBC, which I'd rather see an electrified line that spread through the entire city, actually, an electrified grid. But if we had that line, what the idea is that tax increment financing says the city takes out a bond against the future value of the development of that land. So it's like, okay, well, so we anticipate a bunch of development. We take out a bond against that future tax revenue that the city will make, and then we use it to build in the infrastructure we need, like the housing that we need and the parks and the amenities and the schools and all that kind of stuff. So we're actually kind of getting that money as a loan in advance based on the future value that we'll have.
Quick follow-up on that. Does that mean we're building market instead of affordability units lands?
Personally, I think for transit-oriented development, there should be no market. It should be all purpose-built rental and social housing, public housing. Because fundamentally, we see at the Canby Station, for instance, it's become the Canby Marine Gateway, huge vehicle for speculation, a lot of really shady assignment sales that were going overseas and stuff because it's such a valuable piece to own a It's such a valuable property to own a piece of because it's on a SkyTrain line. It's just bound to appreciate in value. If we took out that whole speculative nature of it, then we're really building housing for the people who are probably most likely to be using the transit in the first place. It's not the millionaires who are speculating on property. And I think we can really, you know, make a more effective use of that really valuable property, keeping it for transit-oriented development out of the market. Still make lots of money off it. I mean, the developers can still make lots of money off purpose-built rental.
Thank you very much. That concludes our time. I believe Margot is more equipped to make valedictory remarks than I am, but I would like to thank
all of you for your participation. We're giving them closing comments.
That's a good valedictory.
So I am more equipped to take the mic at this moment because we have asked each of the candidates to prepare to give 90 seconds of closing remarks. Diego, I'm going to begin with you, but I'm going to slide into that a question that came into us from the audience, which you can choose to answer or not. And the audience question is, what experience do you have with city politics or Vancouver City Administration? So closing remarks, a minute and a half. Diego, you are up first.
All right, well, thank you to everybody who came. Thank you to our moderators, to the organizers. You know, usually I would do this in my opening statement, but I want to also take some time to tell you who I am and who you would be voting for if I am so lucky as to have your vote. You know, I'm a Vancouver resident. I came here as a refugee from Colombia. I'm a former youth in care, and I'm running because I want to bring a fresh new voice to city politics and open up our democracy to young people, to marginalized communities, and to folks who, like myself, have lived experiences that are very political in nature and that are really an expression of social justice and a desire for a more just society. You know, I was very happy to be able to talk today about some of the plans that I put forward, whether it is 1,000 new co-ops, whether it is co-housing, funding the Vancouver Rent Bank, a renter's advocate at City Hall. But I also have been talking to folks at the doorstep, and I know that young people like myself, and you know, we are between the ages of 20 and 30, we have over 100,000 young people in Vancouver, the highest influx of young people in the country. We're not leaving, we're actually coming. And I hear the anxiety that people have, and I'm here to listen to that. You know, I think that we do need to do a better job at listening, and I am committed to doing that. But I don't think listening means that we have to go back to the past with out-of-touch ideas that don't support the new Vancouver, where we all feel included. And on the question of city administration, I've been part of the Cultural Communities Advisory Committee.
You're actually out of time, so finish your sentence.
sorry, being part of the Cultural Communities Advisory Committee and was heavily involved on developing between the city and community the Access Without Fear policy that passed last year in April.
Well, thank you very much. Judy, your closing remarks.
So, I've worked 39 years inside of City Hall from when there was a Vancouver Health Department and up through a variety of mayors and councils. I've seen good policy, I've seen bad policy. I'm such a nerd that I actually watch City Council on Channel 4 TV. I've learned that you can pretty much tell what a city councilor will do by where their money comes from. If it comes from developers, they will develop. If it doesn't, they'll seek other routes. I love the city. I believe the city can be a good place to live in. I work by finding the best inside of each person that I'm with. I'm not interested in making enemies or positioning politically. I have never yet met a person who cannot be part of the solution. And, yeah.
Thank you. Jean, your closing remarks.
Hi, thanks for sitting through all this, you guys. It's been really interesting. I just want to say one thing about the opioid crisis. That's got to be the top priority of anybody that gets elected and everybody that gets elected. We've got to demand from Trudeau clean, safe, and free drugs for everybody. We've got to demand from the province treatment options on demand, and we need the city to build the stalled Aboriginal Healing and Wellness Center. So that's got to be a top priority. So, yeah, thanks for having this meeting, you guys. And vote Swanson if you want fierce action on homelessness and to make our society most equal. And if you want to push the limits of democracy to work for what we really need, a home for every homeless person, a rent freeze, and a mansion tax. And if you want an ally on council to work for free transit and free internet. And if you want someone who's going to push for door-to-door voter registration so that tenants aren't left off the voters list. Vote for Diana Day for school board. She's with COPE. She's an amazing Indigenous woman. She'd be the first Indigenous woman on school board. And she really sticks up for all kids, especially Indigenous and special needs kids. And Saturday, our campaign is having a special meeting at the Britannia Auditorium with Kashama Sawant. She's the Seattle City Councilor, elected twice, the one that's responsible for the $15 minimum wage and the tax on the rich. There's some similarities with our two campaigns, you might have noticed. And so it'll be at 3 p.m. at Britannia, and you're all welcome to come.
Jean, you've had the red flag.
Okay, thanks, everybody. Vote for Swanson and Day, please.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for spending the afternoon or evening with us, folks. I'm just like a regular citizen. I ran in 2014. I got involved in politics because of community advocacy and just working in my community. We're not a developer-run party. We don't take money from the developers, so that forces us to work that much harder. So I do the work. I do the research. Work extra hard. You know, I think when you look at council now, we've had 10 years of Vision Vancouver, and it's really getting us nowhere, and we need that change. We've had 15 years of the BC Liberals, and we definitely don't want to go back to that. The idea that electing a second Green actually amplifies our power, it more than just doubles our power. What it does, it actually lets us second each other's motions. Because right now at City Council, if Adrienne Carr needs her motion seconded, she has to go to somebody from the MPA or Vision Vancouver to second it. That fundamentally is diminishing our democratic process, because the concessions she has to make to get those seconded can mean that those motions are watered down if they even make it to the table. So actually having the ability to second our own motions, further that conversation, force it out into the public, so we have that public discussion, is really a crucial difference when it comes to actually transparency at City Hall. So my name is Pete Fry. I'm hoping you'll vote for me on October 14th. It's only a few days left to go. And I'll work extra hard for you. We've got some great school board candidates, Janet Fraser, Judy Zajowski, and Estrelita Gonzalez. We have a fantastic green slate, and thank you.
Thank you. Hector, you're up.
Thank you so much. And thank you again all for being here. I think we've had a really great discussion. I think there's some really bold ideas. I think if you look at a lot of elections, it's very boring if you're interested in policy. You don't really hear anything new. You don't really hear anything innovative. And I think what's exciting is that we've actually talked about some innovative ideas. We've actually attempted to try to make our city better. You, by being here, attempted to do that as well. And by voting, you do that. And by getting somebody else to vote is even better. With 10% voter turnout, who's going to make our city better than us, right? So that's why I'm standing here, and I strongly believe in evidence-based policy. I want to fix housing in this city. I care about my two boys who were born here. I care about more families being able to choose Vancouver. I care that we've overlooked so many by taking an action. And I will be happy to second any motion from Adrian anytime. And I am willing to work with anyone on council. Now, if Adrian wants to, if she's got a good idea, I will take it. If Vision comes up with a good idea for once, I will take it. But look, I will work with anyone and everyone because I truly believe in nonpartisanship. I think if a good idea is a good idea, I'm here to get the job done. People on our streets, 9,000 less children in our schools enrolled this year. We didn't talk about that tonight. 9,000 less children enrolled in our public schools this year. Families are leaving us. But you and us, all of us together, we can say yes if we want to fix housing. Thank you.
Thank you. So just a few housekeeping things left, but I want to ask, is there a Twitter hashtag anyone is using tonight? And if there is, can you shout it out for anybody else who wants to tweet? Sorry? I didn't hear anything coherent. How about hashtag housing debate?
How about hashtag controlling democracy debate?
Okay, some good ideas.
UBC debate.
Actually, you know, there is a hashtag I vote fan, which is the overall by-election.
Okay, can you just repeat that into your mic?
Hashtag I vote van is the official City of Vancouver by-election hashtag.
Great, and you know what? That's a fabulous segue to the next thing I have to remind you all about, which is to vote. Vote on October 14th. If you want to vote in the advance poll, there's one on October the 10th. But importantly, get out and vote October 14th. And the last thing to say is, first of all, to thank all of you in the audience for coming out tonight, for participating in a key exercise of your civic citizenship. Thank you. I want to thank the candidates as well for participating in also a key exercise of civic citizenship, that is running for political office at what is increasingly an important level of government, local government around the world, but in Vancouver particularly as well. And Tom, thanks. Thanks to the organizers for doing all the hard work behind the scenes for making this event happen.